Okay, welcome to the 11th episode of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. My name is Divine. I am a fourth year medical student, and I am happy to discuss some biochem stuff today. Basically, our discussion today will include the glycogen storage diseases and the lysosomal storage diseases. These are things that are incredibly annoying to learn, but they are very high yield for many exams. They do show up on step one. They certainly show up on step two CK, believe it or not. And they also show up on the pediatrics shelf exam. So it's something you definitely want to know. The glycogen storage diseases, I feel that they are essentially an exercise in logical reasoning. The lysosomal storage diseases, less so. They are mostly more memorization. But I will say that for the LSDs, I'm not referring to the drug LSD, don't think about that, that's bad thinking. The LSDs, lysosomal storage diseases, that's how I'm going to refer to them. The glycogen storage diseases, I'll refer to them as GSDs. The LSDs are more memorization based, but there are a few like key things you want to know about each one that should help you spot it on the exam. So let's jump right into it. So the glycogen storage diseases. Before we jump into the diseases, I believe it's worthwhile to have a very quick review of glycogen metabolism. So we all know that glycogen is a storage form of glucose. And there are two high-yield organs in general that help with storing glucose as glycogen. That'll be liver and muscle. Liver and muscle. Now, how do we make glycogen? We obviously make glycogen in a fed state. When you have surplus money in the bank, when you have surplus money coming in, like you have a very high salary or whatever, then you can begin to think of making some kind of savings and sucking away some money in the bank. That's what happens when you're in a fed state. You have a ton of glucose around, you don't know what to do with all that glucose. The next thing you do is to begin to store it as glycogen. So the thing that happens is glucose gets into the cell and is phosphorylated by hexokinase if you're essentially everywhere else in the body, or glucokinase if you're in the liver or you're in the beta cells of the pancreas. So you have phosphorylation of glucose to glucose 6-phosphate. That glucose 6-phosphate is trapped in the cell, and remember that glucokinase is induced by insulin if we're dealing with the liver in this case. So you form glucose 6-phosphate. That glucose 6-phosphate, by some magic, becomes UDP glucose, and then glycogen synthase helps us convert that UDP glucose to glycogen polymers, and those glycogen polymers have alpha-1-4 linkages. But if you're remembering from your med school biochemistry course, glycogen does not just contain the linear alpha-1-4 linkages, it also contains branched alpha-1-6 linkages. Those alpha-1-4 linkages, they are the linear bonds. Those are made by glycogen synthase. Those alpha-1-6 branches are made by, what enzyme do you think? Branching enzyme. So branching enzyme helps you make the alpha-1-6 linkages. And again, remember, the alpha-1-6 linkages are only found at the branch point. And basically at each branch point, you have an alpha-1-6 linkage. And then after that, you have alpha-1-4. So that's how you make glycogen. Now, how do you break down glycogen? Pretty straightforward as well. We said that there are two kinds of bonds. There are alpha-1-4 linkages and there are alpha-1-6 linkages. To break the alpha-1-4 linkages down, we use an enzyme known as glycogen phosphorylase. Glycogen phosphorylase breaks bonds. It breaks the alpha-1-4 linkages in glycogen. It makes glucose 1-phosphate. Some extremely low yield enzyme, phosphoglucomutase, converts the glucose 1-phosphate to glucose 6-phosphate, and then that glucose 6-phosphate is converted to free glucose. And remember that G6P to glucose conversion happens in the endoplasmic reticulum. That's a kind of a spatial regulation, because remember, the conversion of glucose to glucose 6-phosphate, which is the reverse reaction of that, occurs in the cytosol under the action of gluco or hexokinase. You don't want to maintain a feudal cycle, so you try to spatially regulate things. That's why in the endoplasmic reticulum you express glucose 6-phosphatase, and it helps you convert glucose 6-phosphate to free glucose. Now, here's one important thing you need to remember. This glucose 6-phosphate to glucose reaction occurs only in the liver. It does not occur in muscle. Muscle does not have glucose 6 phosphatase. The job of muscle is not to raise blood glucose levels in the setting of a fast. So that is something you definitely want to keep in mind. Muscle can perform glycogenolysis, but its job is not to raise blood glucose levels, unlike the liver. Very important. So we've talked about how you break down the alpha-1-4 linkages with glycogen phosphorylase. To break down the alpha-1-6 linkages, think about it. If forming those alpha-1-6 linkages required branching enzyme, what would be required to break those alpha-1-6 linkages? That would be the debranching enzyme. Now, the thing is, the debranching enzyme is one of two high-yield bifunctional enzymes you want to know in biochemistry. The first one is the combo of phosphofructokinase 2 and fructose 2,6-bisphosphatase. This is the second one. Debranching enzyme is a bifunctional enzyme that has two subunits. One subunit is known as alpha-1,6 glucosidase. The second subunit is known as 4-alpha-D-glucanotransferase. So, alpha-1,6 glucosidase, what it does is it breaks the branching bond and releases free glucose. So, notice a very important point here. I said that in breaking the 1,4 linkages in glycogen, right? You split those off, you form glucose 1-phosphate, it's converted to glucose 6-phosphate, and then glucose 6-phosphatase helps you go from glucose 6-phosphate to free glucose. The alpha-1,6 glucosidase part of debranching enzyme directly splits off free glucose from the glycogen polymer at the branch point. Very, very high yield to know that. Now, the second part, the 4-alpha-D-glucanotransferase, basically the way it works is when glycogen phosphorylase has chopped off alpha-1,4 linkages, and it's about 4 or 6 glucose monomers off of a branch, it stops, and this is where 4-alpha-D-glucanotransferase kicks in. 4-alpha-D-glucanotransferase basically chops up all the remaining 1,4 linkages on the branch point and transfers that to another linear like series of glucose monomers that are all in a linear glycogen structure. And then when you're done with that and you're left with just one, the remaining bond off the branch point, which is the alpha-1,6 linkage, alpha-1,6 glucosidase comes in, chops that off, and again releases free glucose. And then one other thing is that there is an enzyme in the lysosome. This is a minor pathway, but it's obviously important. That's why I'm discussing it. The lysosome has an enzyme known as alpha-1,4 glucosidase, which is also known as lysosomal acid maltase, that also helps you break down glycogen, but it does that in the lysosome. In fact, you'll see a disease I'm going to refer to here. It's not necessarily a glycogen storage disease. You can think of it as being a glycogen storage disease, but actually being a lysosomal storage disease. That's Pompe's disease. We'll talk about that in a bit. But please don't forget this. The acid maltase, the lysosomal acid maltase, is known as alpha-1,4 glucosidase. Do not confuse this with the alpha-1,6 glucosidase. That is one of the subunits of the debranching enzyme. Very high yield to know that. So now that we've talked about these pathways, now let's go into the actual diseases. So the first disease we'll talk about them in order. We'll talk about glycogen storage disease types 1, 2, 3, and 5. And I may say some things about type 6 because it's like something that's sort of good to reason through with biochemistry, but it's highly unlikely you would ever see that tested on exams. And actually, real quick, one other thing I will mention is that the liver, right, we already said that the liver helps to raise blood glucose levels in the fasting state. Another thing the liver does is it participates in the Cori cycle. The Cori cycle is basically a cycle that takes lactic acid from other parts of the body, say for example red blood cells, and then it basically takes that lactic acid through the process of gluconeogenesis, reconverts it back to glucose by some mechanisms we'll discuss in a later podcast, and then that glucose is then resupplied to blood, to tissues in the body. So that's one thing you want to keep in mind. Cori cycle is a lactic acid dealing with cycle, if you may. Okay, so the first disease is von Gehrig's disease. Von Gehrig's disease is glycogen storage disease type 1. Okay. And the deficient enzyme in von Gehrig's disease is glucose 6 phosphatase. Now, what did I just say about glucose 6 phosphatase? I said that glucose 6 phosphatase is found in liver, but it is not found in muscle. So, if you have a problem with the liver enzyme, right, and you cannot release glucose into the bloodstream, all the sugars in the liver, like glycogen, or if you're trying to perform gluconeogenesis, where you're trying to like, oh, you've done the whole thing from pyruvate, blah, 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 and you've gotten back to glucose 6 phosphate, and then you're like stuck because you can't convert that glucose 6 phosphate to glucose, those sugars will osmotically attract water into the hepatocytes, and that will cause an explosion of those hepatocytes. So you'll very clearly have liver symptoms if you have von Gehrig's disease. But ask yourself this question: would you have muscle symptoms? I hope you're saying no, because again, there is no glucose 6 phosphatase in the liver. There is no glucose 6 phosphatase in the liver, and I mean, sorry, in the muscle. But you do have that enzyme in the liver. That's why you have liver symptoms. Now, do you get a lactic acidosis in von Gehrig's disease? The answer to that is yes, because again, think about this: glucose 6 phosphatase is a pretty ubiquitous enzyme. If you're undergoing glycogenolysis, the final step of glycogenolysis is going from glucose 6 phosphate to glucose, which is what glucose 6 phosphatase helps you accomplish. In addition, if you're also performing gluconeogenesis, right, where you're basically using any kind of feedstock like lactic acid or whatever to ultimately reform glucose that the liver then supplies to other organs of the body, the final step as well is going from glucose 6 phosphate to glucose. And again, you need glucose 6 phosphatase for that. So because you have this very terminal enzyme deficit, none of those pathways to raise blood glucose levels work. And if those pathways do not work, you have a very severe lactic acidosis because you've basically shut down the Corey cycle, which I mentioned a few minutes ago. This is why glycogen storage disease type 1 is really bad. You get a very nasty high anion gap metabolic acidosis. Contrast this with glycogen storage disease type 6. This is the one I said is like basically highly unlikely to ever be tested on the exam. But the reason I'm bringing it up is that it's a deficiency in glycogen phosphorylase in the liver. It's a liver, like hepatic glycogen phosphorylase deficiency. And as you expect, because it's a liver enzyme problem, not a muscle problem, you have like the hepatomegaly, like you get in von Gehrig's disease. But the big thing here is that you, in general, will not have a lactic acidosis, and you also generally will not have a severe hypoglycemia. The reasoning behind that is, yes, glycogenolysis is not working because your glycogen phosphorylase is out of commission, but your gluconeogenesis in the liver is alive and well. It's alive and kicking really well. The reasoning behind that is that gluconeogenesis does not depend on glycogen phosphorylase, and you still have intact activity of glucose 6-phosphatase. That's why HERS disease, glycogen storage disease type 6, is actually not as severe, because one of the two pathways between glycogenolysis and gluconeogenesis still functions. In this case, gluconeogenesis still functions in the liver, so you don't get a very severe hypoglycemia, and you also do not get a severe lactic acidosis. And the way you treat glycogen storage disease type 1 is by giving cornstarch. Basically, cornstarch is a very slow, think of it as controlled release glucose in your body. So you basically never get into hypoglycemia, because if you think about it, the trigger for the symptoms of von Gehrig's disease is any kind of fasting state, any state where you basically need to chop up raise blood glucose levels in some way, shape, or form, which is usually in the fasting state. So those people in general, they just should not fast, and they should also sort of get cornstarch to sort of maintain a basal blood glucose level. So that's it with von Gehrig's disease. Let's go ahead and jump to Pompe's disease. Pompe's disease is GSD type 2. The classic exam question is a 2-year-old with heart failure. The reasoning behind this, no one necessarily knows, but if you ever see a child, 2 years of age or a little younger than that, they have a big heart, cardiomegaly, they have heart failure, and they talk about like the presence of inclusion bodies, if you may, in the lysosome. Think about Pompe's disease. That's GSD type 2. The enzyme deficiency is in the lysosomal acid maltase, also known as the lysosomal alpha-1-4 glucosidase. Okay, this is actually a lysosomal storage disease, but I guess it's also classified as a GSD. Now, let's jump to type 3, the type 3 GSD. This is Corey's disease. The enzyme deficiency here is the debranching enzyme. Okay, now the thing is, debranching enzyme is found in both liver and muscle, right? So because it's found in both liver and muscle, you should have liver symptoms in Corey's disease, but you should also have muscle symptoms in Corey's disease. Okay, do you have a lactic acidosis? You actually don't. Because the thing is, yes, debranching enzyme is necessary for glycogenolysis to help you raise blood glucose levels, but gluconeogenesis is still intact, okay? Remember, debranching enzyme is not necessary for gluconeogenesis. It is only necessary for glycogenolysis. And I really hope with all these things I'm discussing, you're beginning to come up with this construct that there are two pathways in the liver that help to raise blood glucose levels, either glycogenolysis or gluconeogenesis. If both pathways are knocked out, you have a very severe hypoglycemia, that's one, and you also have a severe lactic acidosis. But if glycogenolysis is not working, which is what happens if you have like a glycogen phosphorylase problem, or you have a debranching enzyme problem, but gluconeogenesis is working just fine, you generally do not have any lactic acidosis, because gluconeogenesis will help you deal with that lactic acid from the Corey cycle, and gluconeogenesis will also help you raise your blood glucose levels. So in GSD type 3, Corey's disease, debranching enzyme deficiency, yes, you have liver and muscle symptoms because that enzyme is found in both organ, in both parts of the body, but you do not have lactic acidosis because gluconeogenesis is alive and well. We're not going to worry about the treatment of Corey's disease. Now, the final disease I'll talk about, Mercado's disease, that's GSD type 5. Okay, GSD type 5. This is basically a deficiency in glycogen phosphorylase, but in the muscle isoform. So this is the one that operates primarily in muscle. If you have a deficiency of the myophosphorylase, that's the term used to describe it, the myophosphorylase, so the muscle glycogen phosphorylase, you clearly have no problems in the liver. So if you have no problems in the liver, right, you should already begin to tell yourself that, one, you won't have any liver symptoms. Two, because the liver is alive and kicking well, you would not have any problems with glycogenolysis in that organ. You would not have any problems with gluconeogenesis in that organ. So you will not have a lactic acidosis in Mercado's disease. You will not have a severe, you won't have a fasting hypoglycemia in Mercado's disease. But the only problem you will have is you will have muscle weakness or like muscle pain when you exercise. So the classic description is an athlete. The athlete is he works out or plays sports for like 15-20 minutes and then his muscles begin to hurt. That's Mercado's disease. And what's the mechanism behind that? The mechanism behind that is that when you exercise, you go into a hyperadrenergic state. That hyperadrenergic state makes you make more epinephrine. That epinephrine can go ahead and act on beta 2 receptors on the surface of skeletal muscle. Remember, your skeletal muscle has no receptors for glucagon. So beta 2 receptors, surface of skeletal muscle, epinephrine acts on that. Remember, that's a GS coupled G protein coupled receptor. So you increase the activity of adenylate cyclase, you convert ATP to cyclic AMP. That cyclic AMP activates protein kinase A, and then that protein kinase A, by some magic, activates glycogen phosphorylase. Okay, so in that exercise state, that's where you really depend on the glycogen that's stored in muscle so that you can get some glucose for that muscle to work. Okay, remember again, muscle does not raise blood glucose levels. It uses its glycogen for itself. So that's why you get predominantly muscle symptoms. But again, no lactic acidosis, no fasting hypoglycemia. And one easy way to remember this is Mercado's disease has an M in the name. Muscle has an M in the name. That helps remember that this is predominantly a muscle problem. So if you understand what we just talked about, you're well on your way to understanding all the glycogen storage diseases. So now, the next diseases I'm going to talk about are the lysosomal storage diseases. The lysosomal storage diseases. These ones are kind of annoying because you primarily need to memorize what's going on here. But I would basically try to cut out all the fluff and give you only the high-yield things that are classically tested on exams. Okay? Classically tested on exams. And this is something that's is one of those things that, oh, like the day before your step one exam or step two or pediatrics shelf, probably a good thing to review these diseases. So let's talk about some general principles first. The first general principle is that your lysosome is an organelle you find in the cell, okay? Remember, your lysosome is sort of like a region of the cell that breaks down stuff. Okay, it's a processing center in the cell. And the thing is, to have the ability to break down stuff, it needs enzymes to make that happen. Okay, it needs enzymes to make that happen. And the thing is, if you're deficient in one of those enzymes that helps you break down stuff in the lysosome, that specific thing, it's not broken down anymore. It begins to build up in the lysosome. It begins to build up in other regions of the body. And that buildup can cause cellular apoptosis. And when you have death of cells, then you have a problem, okay? That is generally the pathophysiology behind most of the LSDs. Now, there are other general principles relating to the LSDs. The first one is that most of them are inherited in an autosomal recessive fashion. Because if you really think about these things, these are primarily enzyme deficiencies. As a general principle, not always true, but as a general principle, enzyme diseases are inherited in an autosomal recessive fashion. So if you blank out on an exam and you know it's an enzyme deficiency on any of your USMLE tests, just call it autosomal recessive inheritance. Contrast that with structural disorders of like red cells, for example, that are usually inherited more in an autosomal dominant fashion. So all the LSDs but two are inherited in an autosomal recessive fashion, okay? The exceptions are inherited in an X-linked recessive fashion. One is a Fabry's disease. We'll talk about that in a bit. The second is Hunter's disease. We'll talk about that in a bit as well. Remember, Hunter, like a hunter marking an X to shoot at. Hunter, X-linked recessive. Fabry's disease, you just have to sort of remember that. Although one way I remember Fabry's disease is if you remember the cable channel FX, Fabry's X-linked, that's how I sort of remember that. Okay, so if they basically mention lysosomal storage disease and they talk about a female on your exam, you absolutely should not pick Fabry's disease or Hunter's disease because they should only show up in boys because they are X-linked recessive disorders. Now, another thing with the lysosomal storage diseases is that they are primarily neurological problems, okay? The only exceptions to that are Fabry's disease and Gaucher's disease, and we'll talk about that again in a bit. So let's jump right in. Fabry's disease. So Fabry's disease, we already said, is X-linked recessive, okay? Remember, it's one of the diseases that I said is not primarily neurological. Okay, the deficiency, the deficient enzyme here is alpha-galactosidase A. So something builds up, right? So what's the thing that builds up? The thing that builds up in this case is ceramide trihexoside. Okay, and the classic exam presentation is a boy with burning hands and a boy that has anhydrosis. So this boy does not sweat. And again, the reason it's a boy problem is because it's an X-linked recessive disorder. Okay, so again, real quick review. Fabry's disease, X-linked recessive, alpha-galactosidase A deficiency, ceramide trihexoside builds up, and the classic exam presentation is a boy with burning hands and a boy that does not sweat. Good. Next disease, Gaucher's disease. Gaucher's disease. Gaucher's is the second one I said was not primarily neurological, okay? But remember, it's not like Fabry's disease or Hunter's. It's not X-linked recessive. It's actually inherited in an autosomal recessive fashion. And the deficient enzyme here is glucocerebrosidase, okay? Glucocerebrosidase. Remember the U in gluco, right? The U in gluco and the U in Gaucher's. I don't know if that helps you remember anything. Okay. So if you have a deficiency in glucocerebrosidase, right? So hopefully you've already come up with this construct that if you see A's, beyond the name of an enzyme. The thing that comes before ACE is generally the thing that's broken down by that enzyme, okay? So if you have a glucocerebrosidase deficiency, glucocerebroside will not be broken down. So glucocerebroside will build up, okay? So glucocerebroside builds up, and the classic presentation on exams is a boy or girl, okay, with recurrent infections. So that's like a sign of like a leukopenia, or a nasty anemia. That's a sign of low red cells, or bleeding. That tells you that the person has thrombocytopenia. Okay. If you see these clusters of problems, you are hopefully thinking that this person has some kind of bone marrow failure. And that is actually what happens in Gaucher's disease. The thing is, the bad cells, the Gaucher cells, they actually build up and crowd out hematopoiesis in the bone marrow. So you get signs of bleeding, thrombocytopenia, you get signs of infection, leukopenia, and you also get a very severe anemia. So if they give you like a heme deficiency like presentation in the context of a glycogen over lysosomal storage disease, think about Gaucher's disease. And the classic description of the Gaucher cells are that they look like crumpled tissue paper. So if they tell you, oh, a bone marrow biopsy reveals cells that look like crumpled tissue paper, you really want to think about Gaucher's disease. Okay, so again, quick summary of Gaucher's disease: autosomal recessive inheritance, glucocerebrosidase deficiency. So glucocerebroside builds up, the nasty cells, they clog up your bone marrow, so you have ineffective hematopoiesis, and the cells look like crumpled tissue paper on a bone marrow biopsy. Now, next disease is Tay-Sachs, okay? Tay-Sachs, classically in Ashkenazi Jews, okay? It's an autosomal recessive problem. Okay, the deficient enzyme is hexosaminidase A. If you say, oh, Divine, you know what? I want to intentionally forget everything you've mentioned in with the LSDs. I only want to remember one, although I would not recommend doing that. That's generally not congruent with doing well on your board exams. But if you only want to remember one, this is probably the one you should try to remember. Okay, so Tay-Sachs disease, autosomal recessive inheritance, it's a hexosaminidase A deficiency. So the thing that builds up here is GM2 ganglioside. Okay, so GM2 ganglioside builds up. And the classic description on your exams, right? So this is the way they'll test this on exams. They'll describe a kid that is usually less than a year old, usually about 6 months old. And they will talk about this kid, one, losing motor milestones. Two, they'll describe this kid as having an exaggerated startle response. So they may play out this scenario where, oh, the kid is brought to see the pediatrician, and the pediatrician calls out the kid's name, and the kid has this very atypical response to the pediatrician calling his or her name. Another thing is, you also find a cherry red spot on the macula. Okay, remember, a cherry red spot on the macula is, you know, the things you should think about on exams. Either Tay-Sachs, you should think about Niemann-Pick, which we'll talk about next, and you should also think about a central retinal artery occlusion. Okay, although CRAO is in a much older person on exams, not in kids. So Tay-Sachs, autosomal recessive inheritance, hexosaminidase A deficiency, GM2 ganglioside builds up. It's a kid with an exaggerated startle response, cherry red spot on the macula, and no hepatosplenomegaly. Very high yield. No hepatosplenomegaly. That's what will help you differentiate Tay-Sachs from Niemann-Pick. Okay, so Niemann-Pick disease, let's discuss it concurrently with Tay-Sachs disease, right? So it's an autosomal recessive inheritance, okay? Because remember, it's not Fabry's disease, it's not Hunter's disease, okay? So autosomal recessive inheritance, the deficient enzyme is sphingomyelinase, okay? The nice mnemonic you learn while you're studying for your board exams is, you don't pick your nose with your sphincter. Okay, so sphingomyelinase deficiency Niemann-Pick, right? You're not picking your nose. So Niemann-Pick disease, sphingomyelinase deficiency. So obviously the thing that will build up is sphingomyelin, okay? You can chop out sphingomyelin from the sphingomyelinase name, okay? And here you have a cherry red spot on the macula in a kid, but in addition to that, you have hepatosplenomegaly. They have to give you the presence of hepatosplenomegaly. If it's not in the Q stem, do not pick Niemann-Pick's disease. They have, like, if they don't give you that hook, there is no way anyone will ever get the answer right. So they have to give you hepatosplenomegaly plus the cherry red spot on the macula for Niemann-Pick disease. Next disease is Krabbe's disease. Krabbe's disease is also autosomal recessive inheritance. The deficient enzyme is galactocerebrosidase. Okay, so again, please don't confuse. I know these names sort of sound similar, but remember that alpha-galactosidase A deficiency is with Fabry's disease. Glucocerebrosidase deficiency is with Gaucher's disease. Galactocerebrosidase deficiency is with Krabbe's disease. Okay, so Krabbe's disease is a galactocerebrosidase deficiency. Galactocerebroside builds up. Okay, and literally the only thing you need to know about the presentation of Krabbe's disease is that it presents with optic atrophy, right? So if they describe a kid, usually with a bilateral afferent papillary defect, because it's a metabolic problem, right? So it'll be very weird for the person to just have a unilateral APD. Think about Krabbe's disease. That's literally all you need to know. So autosomal recessive inheritance, galactocerebrosidase deficiency, galactocerebroside builds up, optic atrophy, right? Presenting as bilateral afferent papillary defects. Think Krabbe's disease. Now, Pompe's disease, I'll just again use this as a quick reminder. Remember, it's GSD type 2. Okay. Remember, 2 squared is 4. So that should help you. It's an alpha-1-4 glucosidase deficiency, also known as lysosomal acid maltase. Okay. It's autosomal recessive inheritance. And basically, those people have a buildup of glycogen or like sugar structures in the lysosome. Okay. So inclusion bodies in the lysosome. And it's usually a kid that's about 2 years old with heart failure. That's the way that presents. Okay. Now, the next lysosomal storage disease I want to discuss is I-cell disease, okay? I-cell disease. It's also inherited in an autosomal recessive fashion, okay? And the deficient enzyme is actually in a phosphotransferase, okay? A phosphotransferase. So, if I just said that the deficient enzyme is a phosphotransferase, what does this enzyme do? Well, hopefully you remember that what it does is to add phosphate to mannose residues, okay? To basically add mannose 6-phosphate to proteins, okay? Because the thing is, if you add mannose 6-phosphate, right? So just sort of think of it this way. If you want to go to, I don't know, the UK, right? You need some kind of UK visa to make that happen. Now, if you don't have a UK visa, you cannot be targeted in an airline to the United Kingdom. So, if you don't have mannose 6-phosphate as a protein, you cannot be targeted to the lysosome. The thing that your visa to get into the lysosome as a protein in general is having a mannose 6-phosphate residue. And the thing that makes this happen is a phosphotransferase that is expressed in the Golgi apparatus. Okay, so this mannose 6-phosphate addition happens in the Golgi. And while we're on the subject of the Golgi, I hope you remember that O-linked glycosylation occurs in the Golgi. Contrast that with N-linked glycosylation that occurs in the endoplasmic reticulum. So, phosphotransferase deficiency, so you do not add mannose 6-phosphate to proteins. So, instead of these proteins to go to the lysosome, they're actually targeted for the... the ER pathway, and they are targeted to outside the cell. So these people, the exam question will classically mention that they have increased levels of lysosomal proteins in the blood, okay? Because again, it's a targeting problem, okay? So if you see that, think about I-cell disease. Now, next one I'm going to discuss is metachromatic leukodystrophy. This is also autosomal recessive inheritance. The deficient enzyme is aryl sulfatase A, okay? And if you have a sulfatase deficiency, sulfatides will build up, okay? And the thing is, this is a very hard question for them to test because it's very nonspecific. These people primarily have neurological problems. And it usually shows up mostly in teenagers on exams, although it could show up in kids, but mostly teenagers. But they almost always mention something about the person having a buildup of sulfatides, and they have like problems with myelin. So that's why it's called metachromatic leukodystrophy. The enzyme deficiency is aryl sulfatase A. Now, the last diseases I'll talk about Hunter's disease and Hurler's disease. I'll discuss these side by side because they have many things in common, but they also have some key high yield differences. Hunter's disease, remember, Hunter marks a spot with an X, right? So this is X-linked recessive, just like Fabry's disease, remember FX. And the deficient enzyme in Hunter's disease is iduronate sulfatase, Okay, iduronate sulfatase in Hunter's disease. Now, the thing is, notice iduronate sulfatase does not have an L as part of the main. I know there is an L in sulfatase, but contrast this with alpha L iduronidase. Alpha L iduronidase has like a big L sort of sticking out at you in the enzyme, in the deficient enzyme's name. So that should help you remember that L, alpha L iduronidase L, Hurler's disease. But you don't have that big L sticking out at you in Hunter's disease. So that should help you remember that it's just an iduronate sulfatase deficiency. Okay. And the thing that builds up is dermatan and heparan sulfate. So dermatan and heparan sulfate. That's the, also the same thing that builds up in Hurler's disease. Okay. But the big thing you want to remember is that these people do not have coarse facial features. Okay. And they do not have dysostosis multiplex. Dysostosis multiplex is just a cluster of skeletal findings. You'll find this in like different bones in the body. I will highly encourage you to just go ahead and look up like a radiograph online. It's usually, it's actually pretty striking when you take a look. So, Hunter's disease, X-linked recessive, iduronate sulfatase deficiency, dermatan and heparan sulfate buildup, and no coarse facial features, no dysostosis multiplex. Contrast that with Hurler's disease, that is autosomal recessive inheritance, okay? Hurler has an L in the name, okay? So this is an alpha L iduronidase deficiency, okay? And again, dermatan and heparan sulfate both build up just like Hunter's disease, but these patients have coarse facial features and they have dysostosis multiplex, okay? Coarse facial features and dysostosis multiplex. You do not find these in Hunter's disease. So, quick comparison of Hunter's and Hurler's. So, Hunter's, X-linked recessive. Hurler's, autosomal recessive. Hunter's, iduronate sulfatase deficiency. Hurler's, alpha L iduronidase deficiency. The thing that builds up in both is dermatan and heparan sulfate. In Hunter's disease, you do not have coarse facial features or dysostosis multiplex. In Hurler's disease, you do have coarse facial features and dysostosis multiplex. Okay, so I hope you find this podcast useful. I will say that this podcast is super, super, super high yield for whatever exam you will take until you graduate from med school. So I highly encourage you to just, I know it sucks, but just sort of sit down and learn these diseases. I think if you really understand my line of thought for the GSDs, you should have those down and it should actually be pretty hard to forget because at least we try to talk about pathophysiology and mechanisms with that. The lysosomal storage diseases, I think if you sort of follow like the different like memory cues we use for them and the different things I just highlighted, which is much less than what you see in like a big text, I think this should also lead you well on your way to remembering these diseases for your exam. Okay, so I wish you all the best. I will see you in the next Divine Intervention podcast. Have a wonderful night and God bless.